So one of the questions is a series of questions that I work with regularly in my own practice that I find to be instructive and nourishing and onward leading are these questions that relate to the ground of practice, the path of practice, and the fruits of practice, trusting in this path of practice. So I think about the ground of practice with a question like this that says, why am I here? What brings me to practice? And for you, you know, why are you here? What brings you to practice over and over and over again? And my hunch is that many of us here have been practicing for a long time, but there's something that is happening that nurtures the ground. What is that driving force that is inside of you that says, I'm going to keep doing this? Is there some sort of a sense of longing that gets met when you sit down and bring your practice into this alive space? And I'm not just talking about meditation here. I'm talking about our practice both on the cushion and how it shows up in daily life. What is that thing that says, oh yeah, I want to be doing this? What do we discover? What is happening from the inside out? I remember early on in my practice when I would sit down for a long time, actually. And this was many years ago when my children were teenagers. And frankly, I was using sitting practice as a way to escape the conflict of teenagers. And at the dinner table, literally, I would say, you know, I think I'm going to go eat dinner in my closet. I actually did say that. I never did it. But I did discover the depth and the balm of meditation in that time of my life where I went and I sat down and I was quiet. And I thought I was just settling myself. But what was actually happening is I was discovering this enormous inner landscape that I didn't know before. And I keep discovering it through all of these years. There's so much that is revealed and that is nurtured in this discovery and in this ground. And so when I think about that question, what brings me to practice? What am I doing here? I understand it deeper and deeper. Around I'm learning more about myself and how I can take that learning and bring it into how it translates into the rest of my life. And then there's the path. So we can talk about oftentimes the phrase, the path of practice is a widely used phrase, but to ask yourself, what does that mean for you? What is this path of practice? What are the efforts that we make or the literal practices that we do that provide support, that lead to a depth, increased awareness, compassion, and wisdom. The path of discovering who we are is what I think happens. The revealing, the unfolding into the Dharma itself, the path of the Dharma. And many of us will define Dharma in different ways. The word itself, you know, sometimes it's defined as what the Buddha taught, the teachings of the Buddha, or the truth. And I'm careful about using that word, what is the truth, because I want to honor that there are many wisdom traditions, many lineages that talk about paths of practices. And for me, the way I relate to the word Dharma as a path of practice is this continual understanding and deepening of knowing very directly the way things are, the nature of things. That's how I relate to the path of practice, is being in relationship with the nature of things. Maybe it's pleasant, maybe it's unpleasant, maybe it's somewhere in the middle. Where are my thoughts around that? Do I have judgment? Do I not have judgment? The way things are means so much, because what are the filters through which I'm looking to understand the way things are? But this path of practice reveals these truths, the truths of impermanence And as we were joking early on, you know, that I think Bill said, you know, a Nietzsche sucks. Well, sometimes I think, thank God for impermanence. It's really, really actually fantastic. And, you know, things change for the better. They change for the worse, depending on what's happening for us. They change sideways. Maybe it's neutral. But this path of practice, this Dharma, reveals the truth of impermanence. It reveals the dukkha that exists for all of us, the Four Noble Truths, that dukkha is real, it's ubiquitous, and our work is to not make a difficult thing more difficult through all of these beautiful practices that we have, and the truth that everything is connected to everything else. So this path of practice for me broadens my perspectives through the practices of clarifying my mind, expanding the relationship that I have with whatever is arising, the way of things. So as an example, what I mean by that, I use the word awareness and mindfulness fairly interchangeably. So one of these pieces that I started to understand that becomes one of the fruits of practice, what am I learning? What are the things that are really happening here? Is that I could have a relationship with whatever is arising in me, and I could choose to change some languaging. So I learned this actually from Joseph Goldstein, and it was a profound piece for me. I heard him say once, we have this way of speaking in our language that when certain energies, emotions arise, we tend to say, I am whatever the thing is, right? I am angry. I am happy, which gives us all of this identification with becoming that thing. And his suggestion is, let's change that language and get the I am out of it and shift it to anger is arising, or anger is here. Or it could even be, I feel anger, because that is a very accurate sentence, to feel whatever is here. But when I could shift out of being that thing to noticing that energy, that was a practice of relationship that led to a lot of freedom, to be able to see how I didn't have to become that thing. So as an example, to be aware of joy is not joyful. It is the awareness of joy. To be aware of generosity isn't experiencing generosity. I mean, you could say it is, but we are aware of whatever energy that is instead of becoming it. Are you with me on this? Yeah, okay. I think that this is an important point because it's part of what happens in this practice. So then we can go to the fruits of practice. What have you learned? What keeps you coming back? What has changed you? And that is a question that I ask myself. What has changed me through this practice? And I think that there are some very real things that have changed for me. I think that I have less impulsivity and more capacity to pause, to wait, to say, this is what's happening here. How do I want to respond? To think things over, to understand, because I understand more and more, and not always for sure, the implications of dukkha, the implications of impermanence and the interconnection of everything. There's more capacity to wait and see, to be with, to meet whatever is here. Because everything is precious, everything is temporary, so much happens that is unexpected. And we have choice. We have choice in how we meet our lives. And you know, there's this, I think that commonly when we experience dukkha, especially dukkha, the really painful stuff, we want to know where it comes from. And it's a natural thing. Where is this suffering coming from? Because in the logical mind, if we can understand what these causes, these conditions, where it's coming from, sometimes we can make choices and decisions that help it not happen again. That's a pretty logical way to think. But there's another question that I actually find more fruitful, because over time, I think many of us actually know where our dukkha comes from, and how many times do we go over our past to try to figure it out and figure it out. And at some point, I have found that that is less helpful to me than asking the question, where is this suffering leading? Where is this suffering leading? Because that question takes me to a place where I can use my practice and tap into the resources and tools, these beautiful practices that we have here, to say, okay, here is this difficulty. One of the places it's leading me is to reminding me of the choice to choose kindness, the choice to be present, the choice to respond versus react, and to cultivate some patience with however things are. I read this beautiful definition and essay on patience from Ajahn Suchito, the Parami of Patience, and he defines patience as expanding the edges of time, to expand the edges of time to open up a space where something else can arise. That opened something up for me that has been very beautiful and very helpful around changing my relationship to when I feel the energy of impatience. Can I relax these edges of time? And it takes courage, right? The ground, the path, the fruit, everything that we do to come back over and over and over again. This is not easy. This isn't easy. And we all know that this isn't easy. And one of the descriptions of our practice, sometimes you can hear this as, it's a path of purification. And when I remember when I first heard that, it's a path of purification, it kind of went right by me. I thought, what does that actually mean? What am I purifying myself from? Or what are these impurities that are in me that this practice is going to burn off? And I think that what it is a deeper understanding of the ways that greed and ill will and confusion work, and how they can take up residence in us. And the more we practice and tend to the mind and soften this heart and see what are the habits of mind and heart that cause greater well-being, and see that we have a choice to cultivate that, and what are the habits of mind and heart that cause greater suffering, and what are the practices that we need that support us in letting go of those habits. And in that way, I started to understand more and more about what it means to be involved in a purification practice, a purification of mind and heart. And you have to step your toe into the stream in order for this to happen, right? We can't be on the outside of it. I mean, we can sometimes. Sometimes it's too hard and we take a pause, and that's fine, and that's skillful. But I love this piece from Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass. She said, transformation is not accomplished by tentative waiting at the edge. Transformation is not accomplished by a tentative waiting at the edge. And I think that that's true. And sometimes we are tentative, and that's appropriate. But then sometimes the rubber meets the road, right? And we're in it, and we keep showing up, and something starts to transform in us for the better, that supports our awakening, that supports our clarity of mind. So one of the lists from the Buddha that is helpful to me in supporting this ground and path and fruit are the five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual strengths. You might be familiar with them. Faith or confidence and trust, energy, mindfulness, concentration or stillness, and wisdom. And they're really a beautiful complement to one another. Anybody studied these, this list before? Yeah, okay, good. So we'll talk about it. And as I'm talking, if you feel like you've got a question and you want me to pause, something's up, do that. It's fine to, you know, to interrupt, and I'll let you know if I need a minute before, but it's fine to just pipe up with a question. I'm quite enjoy that. So these five spiritual strengths, let's begin with this visual. Sometimes they're thought of as a team of horses, and a team of horses needs to work together to have balance, to get momentum, to support one another. So in this metaphor, the lead horse is mindfulness. And then the first pair is faith and wisdom, because they support each other. And let's define faith actually here. The Pali word is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A, which is often translated as faith. But my understanding is a more accurate translation of sadha is to place the heart upon. Such a beautiful phrase, to place the heart upon. Also translated as confidence or trust. So what gives us confidence or trust? A certain amount of wisdom in knowing this is good. This path of practice is supportive. This is a good thing that I'm doing. And the rear pair, energy and concentration. So you need a little oomph. I mean, we're talking literally. We're not talking about wise effort here with this kind of energy and effort. We're talking about literal, I think of it as oomph. You know, how much energy do you have in your practice? You show up, we sit down. This is both on and off the cushion. Sometimes we have a lot of energy and sometimes we don't. And that's just how it is. And you can watch what happens to the mind and the heart when the energy is higher. You can see what happens when the energy is lower. And how do we find that balance? Well, some of what needs to balance energy is the concentrated mind, is this stillness, because there's a steadiness that happens there. So when faith and wisdom are in balance and energy and concentration are in balance, the mindfulness, it's said, is effortless. That lead horse of mindfulness just happens naturally. It can lead, it can move freely, because the faith and the wisdom and the energy and the concentration are in balance and are supporting it. So confidence, trust, to place the heart upon. Here's a story that I like very much. It comes from one of Mark Nepo's books, and it's an excerpt from the story itself. Ketut was a great teacher because she claimed to know nothing. Many wanted to work with her. Some would make long journeys in hopes of studying with her. But she disavowed any notion that she accepted students. Though to those who showed up, she'd simply say, "Let's just walk together for a while and listen." Three young seekers met in Amsterdam on their way to find her: Gail, a potter from Tucson, Ben, a financial advisor from Dallas, and Jane, a yoga instructor from Portland. And Gail said, "I heard she's very quiet." And Ben added, "I heard she doesn't take many students." And Jane worried to herself that she might be stern. They shrugged and laughed and made their way. A week later, they were sitting with Ketut on a plateau near her home, which overlooked a meandering river. And she began, "You've come a long way to meet yourself." Ben was eager. "There's so much I want to know." And Ketut replied, "You know, there's a line in the Talmud that reads, 'Why ruin a perfectly good question with an answer? Why ruin a perfectly good question with an answer?'" And Gail spoke up and said, "Well, then are there no answers?" And Ketut went on and said, "Life unravels the urge to look for an answer. Instead, we're asked to think of questions as teachers to walk with. We're asked to meet questions, not answer them, to give questions away like bread." So this is this faith, this trust and confidence. Can we meet these questions? Can we wrestle with our lives? And can we use our practice actually to support this questioning, this wrestling? Can you trust yourself enough that you can be in the questioning? And sometimes answers definitely arise, and it's great. I mean, we love getting answers to things we're working out. But there's a growing confidence, and this leads to the Buddha when he said, Ehi Passiko, come and find out for yourself. It's such a beautiful, gorgeous instruction. It's one of the things that hooked me in this practice, was knowing that the Buddha said, don't believe me, come find out for yourself. I trust that you can do this. Because when somebody else trusts me, I know I can trust me too. And that happens when we're very little. You know, if you think back, was there a time in your life as a child when you knew that somebody saw something in you that you may not have seen? And there's a way it bolsters us. That's the faith. That's the confidence and trust. And then energy, virya. It's present when we have the confidence and faith in our practice and in ourselves. And it is this way that we are engaged. Engaged with the practice, engaged with our lives, engaged now. And so I think of virya not only with just oomph, because it is that energy, but how much energy do we need for a balanced, clear engagement? So think of the gears of a car. You know, when they're engaged, you can go forward. If you're in neutral, they're not engaged, you can't do anything. So we need some energy to support this engagement. And when I said earlier in our meditation, bring some gentle, kind persistence when you come back and begin again. That's the kind of energy that we're talking about. Not too tight, not too loose. If it's too tight, the mind gets constricted and there's a tightness to it. It's hard to breathe. And if it's too loose, oftentimes we can fall asleep. We just don't have the attentiveness. So we need a persistence that is infused with kindness and gentleness and some determination and also some patience, And mindfulness. Mindfulness, of course, you know, is this non-judgmental awareness, this ability to be right here, right now, present in the mind and in the heart and in the body, this vipassana, clear seeing or insight. That's the definition of vipassana. And oftentimes, you may know this, that the word sati, the Pali word sati, S-A-T-I, is often translated as mindfulness. But I learned from Bhikkhu Anālayo that a more accurate translation of sati is actually a soft receptivity of mind. And it changed something for me in thinking about it like that. A soft receptivity of mind is the quality of mind that needs to be present for the mindfulness to arise. For my keen awareness that's connected to my heart, that's grounded in non-harming, for that to arise, my mind needs to be receptive and soft. It gives us the space to ask, what am I aware of? What am I noticing? Can I feel it in my body? Are there beliefs about whatever it is that I'm noticing? In order to do that, I need some softness. I need some space. Thich Nhat Hanh said, mindfulness allows us to look deeply and see what's going on. It means seeing and knowing what's going on. I love that simple, direct definition of mindfulness, but it's not easy, is it? Mindfulness allows us to look deeply and see what's going on. Well, we look deeply and we see what's going on, but we typically look through our own filters because we can't help it, because we are conditioned beings. And so then our work is to peel back these layers. And this is what I mean about the path of practice and the Dharma, about the way of things, the nature of things, starting to see that more and more clearly. And then concentration, the fourth of these faculties, stillness or samadhi, non-distracted awareness. Maybe you've heard the phrases to gather and collect the mind. I like that a lot because sometimes I can sit down in meditation and I feel like I have all these tendrils of distraction that are all over the place. And so my work is to slowly, one by one, bring these tendrils in to gather and collect this mind to this stillness and start to experience the stability of mind, the clarity of mind that starts to arise. And the literal practice, I described it a little bit in the meditation about one pointed awareness, focusing on one thing to stabilize the mind. And then when the mind gets a little more stable, you can open out the awareness. I think about it as pedaling and coasting. You know, imagine being on a bicycle and you get on a bike, pedal, 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 because you need to stabilize the bicycle to create some balance, to get some momentum going. It's the same thing with stay with the breath, stay with sensation, whatever the one thing is. And then like with the bicycle, once you have momentum and balance, you can coast. Sometimes you can even take your hands off the handlebars and you can coast. And that's this open awareness. But then you get a little wobbly again, you need to come back to this one thing that stabilizes. So concentration is developed in that way. And the more concentrated the mind, quiet, steady, then insights tend to arise quite naturally. Insights into impermanence, insight into dukkha, interconnection. In Karen Mazin Miller's book, Paradise in Plain Sight, she is a Zen priest in Los Angeles. She says, "These days I want nothing more than to enter an empty room with a group of strangers and sit still and quiet in samadhi, non-distracted awareness, for the better part of the day. I'm always astonished by the presence of people who would dare do such a thing, to burn perfectly good daylight to get nothing done." And we know we're not getting nothing done. We know that for sure. But it is this is a courageous practice. And the joy, I'll speak for myself, the joy I have every time I come to, whether it's a Zoom room or a room in person with people that I probably don't know, and sometimes I do know, and we sit down together quietly. There's something so courageous about that and so beautiful. And then she says, to take responsibility for peace in your world is genuinely heroic. And she's saying our practice is genuinely heroic, because in the sitting down, in the cultivating of these qualities, we're cultivating peace, peace inside of ourselves. And then that gets reflected, hopefully, to others and makes positive change. She says we have the power to transform everything when we have the courage to do nothing. And so out of this quiet mind comes the wisdom, as Jack Kornfield says, the one who knows, the deeper inner knowing of how things really are. How do greed, hatred, and confusion work in us? What is it like when they get uprooted and we go through the cycles of them? What is it like when we get the deeper understanding of the way dukkha operates, the way impermanence, etc., operates? Gil Fronsdale says this great thing about practice in relation to these five faculties. He says, the process of practice itself is self-correcting, and it guides the mind to greater peace and freedom. What I love about that, the process of practice itself is self-correcting, and that takes us all the way back to confidence. We can trust this. We can trust this practice. And when it's hard, and you know it's hard, and you might be in a tough part of a cycle with practice, you can rely on what Bhikkhu Bodhi tells us, which is to just do two things: begin and keep going. Begin and keep going. And lastly, from Zen practice, when you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. When you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. So you can trust the ground, the path, and the fruit. And you can, if you can, let it be supported with these five faculties of confidence, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. Thank you, everybody. Let's spend some time talking with each other. Plenty of time to talk, ask questions, and make contributions to our practice tonight. You're welcome to unmute anytime. Yes, please. I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Will you tell me, please?
A computer crashed, so our names crashed with it. Oh. I'm Barbara.
Barbara, thank you.
I just wanted to thank you for the talk. I really, really enjoyed it. And I love the five horses. I've always had trouble keeping those five faculties in my mind. This will do it. I have so much.
I'm so glad. You know, I learned that from Kamala Masters. And because it stuck with me. And this is how this works. You know, we hear these things from each other and go, oh, yeah, and that's the power of metaphor. It's so wonderful. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Yeah. Welcome. Yeah, Patty, please.
Thank you for that. That was very inspiring. I particularly liked during the guided meditation, the idea of getting close to the stillness.
Yeah.
I could feel the stillness almost like a pillow around me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And when you said get close to it, I just love that image of becoming closer to that sense of support and stillness and comfort and safety. It all came together when you suggested that we get close to the stillness, and that was a beautiful image. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Use it. You know, play with it, get creative with it in your practice, because it's actually there. You know, maybe it's not always there, but in the moments when you can sense that, that's another place where you can trust it. You can rest there. Thank you for telling me, Patty. Who else? Corey, please.
Hi, this is Margaret behind me.
Hi, Margaret. Nice to meet you.
I love the question, but I wasn't quite sure about it. Where is suffering leading me? And so I was going to ask about that. And then later on, you said, you know, that piece about why waste a good question with an answer. And I realized that question is really that kind of a question.
Isn't it?
A question to sit with. So I don't know if you want to say anything more about it or not, but I appreciate it a lot.
You know, yeah, you know, I think that the place where suffering led me to begin with was practice. And we could probably all trace back what got me here, you know, what got me here. And it's some amount of dukkha, some amount of not quite rightness, you know, a feeling like, ah, oh, I need something. And, you know, the something of coming into a practice like this is so big, because there's so much that we experience. But sometimes there's a specific answer to that question, right? That the specific answer could be noticing a certain habit that, oh, this, I keep doing this same thing over and over again, and it's leading to more suffering. So now, where is the suffering leading? The awareness of the habit itself. And then, can I let go of something that is unskillful? So I think it's both an unanswerable question and also an answerable one, because it can be really specific. So it's both. Yeah, thank you for commenting on that. I love the wrestle. You know, I really, really love this teasing apart how the Dharma works. and without having to have an answer, but just the chewing on it. Who else? Yeah, Mary, please.
So I really liked when you talked about patience, and then and reading that, and then that it's the, yeah, it's expanding the space. And, you know, I have grown sons, and I too. They were good, but you know, teenagers are teenagers. I don't care. You know, people that we love sometimes are the very ones that we need to have the most patience with. And sometimes it's even ourselves.
Totally.
You know?
Totally.
And I think for me, one of the things I found with that is that there is a, being impatient is such a feeling of tightness.
Yeah.
Everything gets smaller. And when you think of it, for me, when you think of it, it's just, yes, there's enough expanding that space. It's like, it softens. And it not only softens me, but if there's a real felt sense in my heart space.
Yes, exactly.
That I can have room for this too. And I think that one of the things I found was like, especially now that I'm getting older, it's really important to have patience with myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing something today and I just thought that somebody's name just like, it just disappeared.
Oh my God, I know.
And I thought, you know, it's going to come back. And just, you know, I just wait. And I just think that that is such a, I don't know. It does take courage. And at the school I worked at, they had this whole tool bag. And one of the things they had when the tools was patience. And they said, I'm strong enough to wait.
That's beautiful.
And I really think that people don't realize that when you are practicing patience, there's a lot of strength and courage that's there. It's, you know, some people think that, you know, you're being a doormat, whatever. You know, you're not being weak. You're able to hold the space.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're holding the space for somebody else, and that really helps them. I mean, I know that, you know, when I'm struggling, the last thing I need is somebody being impatient.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was just, Anna, such a beautiful reminder. So, yes, thank you for that, too.
No,
yeah.
You're welcome. You know, Suzuki Roshi, he, in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, if you have that book, pull mm-hmm. out that chapter on patience, because the way he talks about mm-hmm. patience is that to be patient,
mm-hmm.
you know, the language that we have, be patient, actually puts us in contention mm-hmm. with whatever is happening, because we are like gritting our teeth until something else happens. And so how he talks about patience is he talks about the Japanese word nin, N-I-N, which is similar, which it actually means constancy. So the ability to abide, to be with. And he says, let me see if I can pull up the quote. It's like an unwavering ability to abide with what is here. And the word nin means constancy. And if we think about anicca, which is inconstancy, and nicca, there's some language, interesting language around, you know, in the Pali, when a word starts with the letter A, it implies the negative. So impermanent versus nicca would be permanent. And the Japanese word nin, I kind of geek out about that kind of language stuff. I think it's really fun. So to think about it as constancy, this unwavering ability to be with things as they are, And that's not easy. But mm-hmm. to relax the edges of time, when we think about from that space, so there's space for something else to arise. That's an amazing skill. Mm-hmm. And if we go back to, you know, Gil Fronsdal defines equanimity as the ability to say, let's see what happens next. So what is then the relationship between patience and equanimity?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can start seeing how all of these different paramis and these qualities are completely interdependent and interwoven. And maybe, you know, there are subtle differences, but to your point, mm-hmm. can I just wait? And the waiting, you know, part of the practice of the waiting is, what does that feel like in my body?
God.
Yeah. Or the literal ants in your pants energy, like standing in the grocery line at 5 o'clock, you know, and somebody, you have one thing and somebody else is in front of you and you just want to get home and make dinner. And then it just, then they have a return and then they got the coupons and they got the this and the that. And so then there's this difficult energy can arise. And we think, I just got to be patient. All right, put my feet on the ground, just feel myself here, take a breath. This is how it is. Can I expand the edges of time? Okay, mm-hmm. dinner's going to be a half an hour later than I thought. Oh, well, that's just an externally imposed timeline. Maybe. I mean, maybe there's some appointments, but yes, 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 and yes, to your point. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else? We have a couple more minutes. If you have Suzuki Roshi's book, check out the piece on patience. It's really interesting. And also read on the paramis on patience. It's so lovely to be with everybody. Thank you for coming tonight and being so kind and warm with me. Any other questions? Okay, so remembering that we offer up the goodness of our practice for all beings, and we are included in all beings.